listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
I'm Rosalind English, and in this podcast I'll be talking to Marina Wheeler QC about the way the civil courts deal with radicalisation. The risk of adults and children being set on a pathway to terrorism is usually thought of as being the preserve of the criminal law, but often this is not appropriate, either because there isn't sufficient evidence for a conviction, or the evidence is too sensitive to be admissible in open court, or the subject involved is a child. So we have what used to be called control orders, now terrorism prevention and investigation measures, to restrict the activities of adults suspected of terrorist activities, and child protection proceedings under the prevent strategy in the family courts. Marina has herself acted on behalf of the police in some of these cases, and other members of chambers such as Martin Downs and Shaheen Rahman have also been involved. It's a new and evolving area of the civil law that entails quite difficult questions of evidence and intervention. Marina, these terrorism prevention and investigation measures, or TPIMs, what are they and when can they be used?
Well, a TPIM is generally used to control the activities of people who are thought to pose an immediate and quite significant terrorist threat, but for various reasons they can't be prosecuted or deported. So they are specifically geared towards what will inevitably be quite a small group of people. That's their purpose. About when they're used, the Secretary of State takes the decision, the Home Secretary takes a decision to seek a TPIM. And a TPIM is essentially a notice of a whole clutch of measures that are imposed on an individual. But there are a number of threshold conditions that are set out in the Act that creates the TPIMs that have to be satisfied in order for one to be imposed. And just skipping through those, in order to seek one, the Home Secretary has to be satisfied on a balance of probabilities that someone either has been or is involved in what's referred to in legalese as terrorism-related activity. And the Home Secretary has to also consider that it's necessary to impose some measures in order to protect the public from a risk of terrorism. And then the sort of final element is that the Home Secretary has to consider that it's necessary in order to prevent someone's involvement in terrorism for the specific measures that are set out in the notice to be imposed on that person.
And these measures replace what I remember were called control orders.
They're an evolution, I suppose one could say, of the control order. And you may remember that control orders came in, I think they came in 2005, but were quickly subject to a number of challenges by the courts, in part because in the early days, the control orders themselves weren't subject to the kind of review that now exists by the courts. And also, those subject to the control orders didn't have the same access to evidence and material that is being used or relied on by the Home Secretary. But in terms of the actual measures that can be imposed on someone, the TPIMs that we have now, and this is since further reform in 2015, in fact do impose similar kinds of constraints on individuals.
The restraints that they impose, one thinks immediately of curfews and electronic tagging, but it's more subtle than that, isn't it?
I suppose it's more subtle. It's certainly more extensive. Some of the restraints are, as you describe, restraints that people may be familiar with from the imposition of bail conditions. But the most controversial element that can be used in the modern TPIM, and some people refer to them as TPIM Mark II, is a compulsory relocation requirement. And I should say, before I go on to perhaps sketch out some of the restrictions, that this relocation requirement has always been one of the most controversial elements in these orders. And when the control orders were abolished in 2011 under the coalition government, it was in part surrounding concern about how draconian a relocation condition was. And when they were replaced with TPIMs in 2011, initially there was no power to compulsorily relocate someone. Now that omission, or watering down as many people saw it, was thought after some years of TPIMs falling into disuse, in a sense, advice was given by the then independent reviewer of counterterrorism legislation that it should be reintroduced. So this relocation, compulsory relocation requirement came back in 2015 and is only recently being processed through the courts.
In a kind of real life situation, why would such an order be necessary?
Well, they're thought necessary because quite often those who are subject to these TPIM orders come from an area of the country where there is a very well-established community that may be thought to be a particular location where extremism is rife. And that may be because it's focused around a particular mosque or clutch of mosques. It's essentially to disrupt networks of extremism. So the idea is that you take an individual out of their locality and place them somewhere, which can be quite far away, without any established network.
So this really demonstrates the whole thinking behind these measures, that they're not an ad hominem form of punishment, they're a preventative measure.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important distinction, because those who are made subject to them generally haven't been convicted of a criminal offence, but there is reason to believe that they are involved in terrorism. They've not been convicted generally because it's thought that there isn't admissible evidence that could found a successful prosecution. But the preventive element is to disrupt networks. And the other restrictions that can be imposed, I think, also illustrate that. So, for example, many TPIMs will include what's referred to as a travel measure. So the person subject to the TPIM can't travel out of the jurisdiction without the consent of the Home Secretary. Another measure is called an exclusion measure, which stops them from entering premises that offer internet access, travel agencies, shops selling computers. Railway stations are also often part of the exclusion measure. And then there's financial services measures as well. So the subject of the TPIM can only use a nominated bank account, can't withdraw more than a certain amount of cash, and their use of electronic equipment is also severely restricted. Generally, they'll be restricted to using one computer and one mobile phone, which will be subject to checking by the Home Office on a regular basis. And then there's an association measure that can be included, which restricts those individuals with whom the TPIM subject can associate. And interestingly, one recent innovation of the 2015 reforms is something called the appointments measure. And that requires, where this is an element that's included, it requires the person to attend and meet with what's referred to as an intervention provider. And stripping away the jargon, that is someone who is meant to meet and discuss the TPIM subject's extremist views and try through that interaction to challenge their beliefs, introduce other perhaps religious discussion about theology, but which is moving away from the more extremist elements and moving away from a commitment to terrorist activity.
This huge commitment on the part of the prevent strategists, for want of a better word, must entail not only the need for society to disrupt these organisations, but also good evidence that any particular individual is at risk of being related to terrorist activities. There is a problem with this evidence, isn't there? Because some of it is, as you said earlier, not admissible. How is that dealt with?
Well, for TPIM proceedings, What has to be established is that the Home Secretary had formed a view on a reasonable basis that an individual has been or is involved in terrorism, and that measures are necessary in order to address that and prevent them or disrupt them from that involvement. But the evidence that will be used to support that judgment in these civil proceedings, much of it will be highly sensitive evidence. And that isn't heard in open court, in open proceedings, which of course is something that would be a requirement if a criminal charge were being advanced. So the way that it works is that these proceedings happen in both open and closed session. Closed session is really where the national security case is advanced in detail and is also challenged. So the way that works is, in order to ensure that they are able in some way to challenge this evidence, they'll be represented by a special advocate. So a special advocate is, as I'm sure you know, a security-cleared barrister who will be shown the sensitive material, after which point they can't any longer communicate with the TPIM subject. But their role then is, as I say, to challenge, and they'll do that in two ways. They'll do it by trying to argue that, where appropriate, the material can be disclosed in open, so can be seen by the TPIM subject and the TPIM subject's advocates, and also that the special advocate, if that information is not put into open, will carry on then and challenge it, for example, by submissions, trying to persuade the judge, for example, that inferences that perhaps the Home Secretary invites the court to draw from some material is not made out, or if live evidence, as it usually is called on behalf of the Home Secretary to sketch out the national security case, the special advocate can cross-examine them and will generally do that pretty vigorously.
This closed material procedure we've become familiar with in other contexts, but it is interesting that it's being called upon in these civil procedures. And I suppose moving on now to radicalisation in the family courts, it's a rather more controversial area, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is more controversial now because it's quite new. It's been developed really by judges. Now, I have to say that TPIMs and control orders, we know, were controversial at the outset, but we now have had a decade of their evolution, of judges scrutinising their imposition and often making judgments which suggest that they go too far or they unreasonably restrict the rights of a TPIM or control order subject. And that in turn then has led to amendment to the legislation. So where we are now with TPIMs, as I say, is an evolution of legislation, challenge, amendment, etc. Whereas with the child protection cases in the family division, we're at the very early stage. And I think I'm right in saying that the first orders of the family courts in this area came in 2014. So that's just 3 years. It's very much evolving now on a trial and error basis.
Why is this intervention needed in family cases? What are these children getting up to?
The immediate trigger for these cases was a concern about children travelling to Syria. So travelling to Syria to join the conflict there, to join the civil war there, to join and thereby face either death or, in the case of girls, face possible sexual slavery abuse at the hands of Daesh fighters. And in fact, I think the first couple of cases, one of which involved a member of these chambers, Martin Downs, in a case, Rewy, that involved a young boy whose family were all known to have travelled to Syria. And indeed, I think I'm right that certainly two, maybe more, close members of his family had died in Syria. And his mother was thought, and this is referred to in the judgment, to be so worn down by grief that she couldn't really exercise control over her teenage son. And at that point, social services stepped in, already knowing the family, to get an order. In that case, it was using the inherent jurisdiction of the family courts to get an order, wardship order, over the teenager, preventing him from traveling to Syria. So if my recollection is right, his passport had to be surrendered. And at that point, once wardship had been ordered, the court took over the role from the parent, from the mother in that case, of taking decisions in relation to the child. So one facet, reason why the family courts get involved and why it's a child protection issue, is travel to Syria. And that might be a teenager choosing of their own will to go, or young children being taken there by parents. But the other facet, which is more nebulous and I think thereby more controversial, is about exposure to extremist views or extremist material, and that the way that that is expressed by the family courts in justifying the intervention is that that is a form of child abuse in itself. But the other facet, which is more nebulous and I think thereby more controversial, is about exposure to extremist views or extremist material, and that the way that that is expressed by the family courts in justifying the intervention is that that is a form of child abuse in itself.
What is happening here is, because of the background of the war in Syria and terrorism in general, is that activities that take place in the home are suddenly regarded as, I think one of the judges referred to them as starting people on a pathway towards terrorist-related activities that would, in any other context and any other time, be completely innocent.
Well, I think through the prevent strategy, there is a recognition that young people can be radicalized in the sense of they can be introduced to extremist views, and they can, whether it's at home or possibly through the influence of a imam or at a mosque, that they can be moved to a position where they are, when they become older, likely to sympathize with extremist activity and thereby be drawn into terrorism. So I think that in itself is not controversial. The controversial part is the intervention of the family courts and what they, as opposed to, say, the prevent program can do to address this and to assist. And I think there's a growing number of cases. The difficulty in this area is that the family courts don't always publish their decisions. So it's quite hard to get, you know, a full picture of the circumstances in which orders are made. But from those that are published, and from my own direct experience, I think it's right that the more straightforward role is when the court will intervene, as in the case I've just described, on a limited basis, to say stop a child or a young person traveling to Syria, because that will pose a very clear threat. But the more difficult intervention, I think, is where the court seeks a broader order, so a care order, for example. And what's striking about and different about a care order is a care order does allow the local authority, essentially it replaces a parent's rights and responsibilities by the local authority. And that means that the local authority can, if they consider it necessary, remove a child from the care of its parents. And of course, that is a very draconian step. And I would certainly argue that before that step is taken, the courts and the local authority have to be very clear about what it is that they're trying to achieve. And in these cases, where the alleged abuse is the form of exposure to extremist material, etc., it's not always clear what a care order can achieve and whether indeed removal from parents might in fact be a counterproductive step.
In one of your posts that you wrote about this on our blog, you quote a judge saying that the violation of a 16-year-old girl's mind was equivalent to a sexual violation. And it's a way of looking at brainwashing as a form of physical abuse.
Well, that is an interesting case. I think that's Tower Hamlets and Bee. And in a sense, that is a perfect example of what I'm saying. I think that is the only case where there's been a care order that's resulted in the removal of a child from a family for any length of time. And in that case, as you say, the judge took the view that the young girl's exposure to extremist material, and I have to say it was at quite a sort of high end of the spectrum, the material in that case, in that I think the family had all sorts of material on their laptops, which included, you know, very graphic depictions of corpses and fighters from the conflict in Syria. And the judge clearly was seeking to remove the young girl from that environment in order to give her some breathing space. She was quite an academic girl. She had, however, tried herself to travel to Syria. So she was pretty determined and set on a path. But he wanted to remove her from her family environment to give the possibility of other influences and allow her the space to rethink her ideas. Now, the trouble was that in reality, the care order didn't achieve what the judge had hoped. The local authority couldn't find a foster family for her, and that meant that she was quite isolated in the event. She was accommodated against her will and so had to be somewhere secure. She didn't attend school. So after a year, she was returned home with conditions attached. But I think what that showed, and the judge was very frank in reviewing this case in saying that it hadn't achieved what he had hoped. And I think that is a lesson that when these orders are sought, and indeed if they're granted, there has to be a very clear idea about what's going to happen. Because trying to change someone's views in a coercive environment is, one would imagine, likely to be quite difficult.
And counterproductive, even. It's one thing taking away somebody's passport, it's quite another trying to change their mind.
Yes, and particularly by removing them from a family which might, in other respects, you know, be very loving and supportive. That is the acute challenge that is posed in these situations. There are other possibilities, and I think everyone agrees that the courts are trying to achieve something that is valuable, but it may be that there are other routes that need to be considered more fully. And certainly, to my mind, the PREVENT strategy is looking to achieve the same thing, in that it is looking to try and work with individuals on a tailored basis to find out what it is that might attract them to extremism and work with them to introduce new influences and ideas, challenge ones that seem destructive, and coax them in that way away from extremism. So it may be that what we need is closer collaboration between the family courts and strategies such as the PREVENT programme.
If you found the topics covered in this interview interesting and want to hear more, make a note in your diary. Marina and others will be discussing radicalisation, closed material procedures and other related matters in a seminar held by One Crown Office Row on Monday the 11th of September. Full details of the seminar will be published on our website and on the UK Human Rights blog.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.